So being here in the sunshine has made me feel so delighted, even more delighted than normally being at Greenbelt. So a very, very warm welcome to you all. I hope that you're enjoying the sunshine and glad to be here. Thank you very much for committing to another weekend with the festival. It feels great already. As Ju said, I'm a trustee. This is the first session in the Pagoda, another honour, but the biggest honour is that we have Satish Kumar with us. I'm going to ask him a few questions about his hugely varied life, and then it would be good if you have questions too, we can put those to him. I think we'll have about 50 minutes together, and I'll kick off if that's all right, and I'll give you the mic, obviously. The thing that interested me... Well, so many things interest me. I'd like to start at the beginning. Is that all right, Satish?
Yeah.
And I was reading in preparation for this that you left home when you were 9 years old and began your walking, really. Would you tell us a little bit about
yes. I was 4 years old when my father died. And I didn't know what was going on. My mother was crying, my sisters were crying, whole family was in mourning, my father is not moving, he's lying in state. So I asked my mother, why father is not speaking, why he's not walking, why are you crying? And my mother said, your father is dead. I didn't know what dead meant. So I said, what do you mean when somebody's dead, everybody start to cry? She said, yes. And then mother said, everybody dies. The mother, you will die? Yes, I will die. And then we will all cry for you? I think so. Then mother, will I die? Yes, you also will die. That was the kind of seed of an idea that made me to leave home. Because I was looking for a life where there is no death. And so I went to see Jain monks. Jain religion is like Buddhist religion, one of the important tradition in India. And so my family belonged to Jain tradition. So I was going to the monks and I asked them, is there any way of stopping people dying? Very simple, innocent question of a child. And so they said, yes, there is a way. According to Jain idea, you can bring an end to the cycle of birth and death by renouncing the world. And so I said, that's what I will do. I will leave home, I'll renounce the world and become a monk. And so at age 9, I left home, I left my mother, I left everybody, bare feet, no money, begging for my food. So a begging, wandering monk. For 9 years, I walked village to village, door to door, asking for food, meditating in the morning, meditating in the evening, and teaching principle of nonviolence and preaching. So I learned preaching from age 9 about nonviolence and peace and love. So that's how I started my life.
That is such an alien concept to us in the West. I mean, I think about my 11-year-old boy, you know, I barely let him cross the road, let alone leave the house. What did your mother say?
My mother was a very religious woman. And so she said, I'll be very sad to lose you because I was the youngest of 8 children. And my father dead and my other brothers and sisters grown up and gone here or there. So I was her company. I was always walking with her. And so she was very sad. But she also said that I don't want to be an obstacle in your religious search and religious path, because she was a religious woman. And she said that I know you are a young 9-year-old boy, but a child is not an underdeveloped adult. Child can make the decisions which inspire the child. And therefore, if this is your heart's longing, if this is what to do, and you are going in good hands, because my guru was very familiar to my mother, she knew him because he was our guru of the family and guru of the whole community, Jain community. And so she said, you are in good hands. And he was like a new father. So, and the other monks, they will teach me. So I will be all right. So she was okay. But my brothers were more concerned. So what can a 9-year-old boy know about religion and all this? They were more strongly sort of against my becoming a monk. But in the end, I managed to persuade everybody.
So can you tell us a bit more about the idea of a guru and how that works? Because we have vicars. Or the idea of following my vicar around London for 9 years is challenging.
Guru is basically a priest, a psychoanalyst, a therapist, a kind of healer, all brought together in one. So whether it is your psychological questions or spiritual questions or relationship questions, your family questions, anything which is bothering you, you can go to your guru, someone you trust. Guru doesn't have to be a famous person. Guru has to be somebody you really trust, 100% trust, and have a kind of faith that if this and the guru will give you advice which is dispassionate. It's not about any ego or any worldly matters. It's a what is really good for you. So kind of spiritual advisor, spiritual guide, if you want to call it. Also, if you have a psychological problem or family relationship problem or marriage problem, anything like that, you have somebody you can go to and ask who will give you a dispassionate advice, not interested in any material success or material situation. There's somebody who can really guide you in your life. And most families, particularly in my Jain tradition, but also other Hindu and Buddhist traditions, you have gurus. And they can be in an ordinary clothes. They don't have to be monks or priests. They can be in ordinary clothes. They can have family. They can have wife, children, grandchildren. They can have farm. But they are spiritual guides. They are spiritual beings. And so my guru was a spiritual guide to all our family.
And so you said you were with the Jains for 9 years as a young monk. What happened when you were 18?
When I was 18, although I was very much grateful to my guru and my tradition, and I was very kind of, I was very committed to the principles of Jainism and nonviolence. But I started to feel a little bit claustrophobic, being in a monastic order, a very restricted life. And so it happened that at that time, about 17, 18 I was, I read a book by Mahatma Gandhi, his autobiography. And the one passage which really stood out for me and really kind of touched me, moved me, and challenged me was where he said, the spirituality is not only for the monks. And if you make spirituality an exclusive situation, exclusive thing, that only the monks who leave the world can practice spirituality, and we are in the world, we have to have money, we have to have a marriage, we have to have business, we have to have politics, we have to have agriculture, farming. We can't practice spirituality. So he said that you don't have to renounce the world to practice spirituality. Spirituality should not be exclusively for the monks and those who leave the world. It should be for everybody. So we have to make our business spiritual. We have to make our politics spiritual. We have to make our agriculture spiritual, our domestic life spiritual. Spirituality in everyday living. How you do it? Gandhi said, how do you do it? His answer was, you change your motivation. You change your intention. You are in business. Why are you in business? Are you in business just for your ego, for your wealth, for your money, for your prestige? for your power, for your control, for yourself. It's material, materialism. But if you are in business to serve the community, look after the planet Earth, look after your in agriculture to look after planet Earth and soil and nature, and you are in politics to take care of the community. If your motivation is right, then even politics can be spiritual. And I can take example now. At that time, Nelson Mandela was not there. But somebody like Nelson Mandela, somebody like Bangari Mathai, somebody who is in politics for the spiritual service of humanity, well-being of humanity, then it's a spiritual practice. So you are in politics, you are in business, you are in agriculture, whatever field you are, if your motivation is right, then you don't have to forsake the world. When I read that, I was challenged. I said, this is what I want to do. I don't want to remain closed in a monastic order. I want to go out in the world and practice spirituality in every moment of my life, in everyday life, living in the world, like Jesus Christ said, living in the world, but not of the world. So you live in the world, engage in the world, but without attachment, without desires for yourself. So that was challenging. And so I became in a kind of Jain, but also a follower of Mahatma Gandhi.
And what did that mean? So you left the monks that you were working and living and traveling with. So where did you live next? What did you do next with that?
So decision? It was not that different. It was not monastic order. But Gandhi and many Gandhian followers started what is called in Indian word or the Sanskrit language, ashram. So I joined a Gandhian ashram where we were taught and we were required to, it's more like a Benedictine ashram maybe, where you work 4 hours a day doing agriculture, or spinning, or some practical work, manual work, to earn your keep, to earn your living. Bread labor, manual labor. So I learned to garden, to cook, to do all the kind of daily life practice. And then the other time, you go out in the community and removal of untouchability, freedom for the women, removal of poverty, in social injustice. So you do social work. So I joined the Gandhian movement, and there was a big movement at that time called land reform movement. And so we were going from landlord to landlord, requesting them, persuading them, inspiring them to share their land with the landless. Don't wait for government to make a law. Don't wait for Marxist and Maoist and communist to come and make armed revolution. With your compassion, with your kindness, with your religiosity, share your land with the landless. And so this Gandhian movement of land reform collected 4.5 million acres of land. And one of the leaders of Gandhian movement was a man called Vinoba Bhave. He walked for 15 years. You are going to talk with me about walking. He walked 15 years, over 100,000 miles. North, south, east, west, center, whole India. And you can say how big is India. For 15 years, collecting land. And thousands of people, including myself, joined this movement of land reform and created a kind of revolution with compassion. It's a kind of revolution with love. Revolution where people share their wealth and their land with the poor. So that was the movement I joined. So I was practicing spirituality, non-violence, Gandhian principles of service and compassion in the real world.
So you invited me to ask you about walking. Yeah. The moment that everyone associates with you is that decision to walk from India to London in the 1960s. Yes. So can you tell me what prompted that decision?
Yes. Inspiration actually came from Britain, from England. In 1961, long time ago, 1961, Bertrand Russell, the great British philosopher, Nobel Prize winning, Lord Russell, he was protesting against the nuclear weapons. So he, with 100 other people, it was called Committee of 100, 100 other people, many writers, poets, playwrights, scientists, professors, they all went to the White Hall in front of the Ministry of Defense and sat down and said, we want British government to ban the bomb. Until you ban the bomb, we are not going to move. Non-violent direct action, very Gandhian. And so Bertrand Russell and these 100 people were arrested. And they were fined £20 each. And Bertrand Russell refused to pay the fine. He said, we are not going to pay the fine. We want British government to ban the bomb. And so because he did not pay the fine, he was put in jail for 1 week. And I was 25-year-old, young man, in a city called Bangalore. And I was with a friend. And we all, both of us went to a cafe and we were drinking coffee. And I read this news in that cafe, in a newspaper. And when I read this, I said to my friend who was with me, said, look, here is a man of 90, Lord Bertrand Russell, philosopher with Nobel Prize, going to jail for peace in the world. What are we doing, young man, sitting here drinking coffee? We must do something. And so that was the inspiration. And we talked and talked. And at the end of our about hour-long talk, we came to this idea that we are walking with Vinoba, and Vinoba had been walking thousands of miles. Why don't we continue this walk and walk to 4 nuclear capitals of the world? Moscow, Paris, London, Washington, D.C. And protest against the nuclear weapons, like Bertrand Russell. Because if we went by plane, nobody's going to take any notice. If we went by car or train or any other means, many people go. But if we walk, people will take interest in our human story, that you are walking all the way from India to America. So that will make interest for media, the BBC, other newspapers, Washington Post, New York Times. They will all take interest. And so that was our decision. And so we went to our teacher, Vinoba Bhave, I mentioned, who was walking, the great walking guru. And we said to him that we want to go for peace in the world, walking. And Vinoba said, if you want to go for peace in the world, you have to be peace. Not only talk about peace, but you have to be peace. You have to be the change that you want to see in the world. That's the Mahatma Gandhi's saying. And how do you be peace? Wars begin in fear. Peace begins in trust. So you have to show that you trust the world. How do you show that you trust the world? How do you show that you trust yourself? How do you show that you trust God? You trust the universe? Carry no money in your pockets. And I heard this. And I said, Vinoba, you mean any money? We are going to unknown countries, unknown languages, unknown religions. How are we going to survive without any money? A bit of money to buy some cup of tea while we are looking for some hospitality? He said, not a penny. If you really want to go for peace in the world, embody the peace. Be the embodiment of peace. An embodiment of peace is being embodiment of trust. So fill your rucksack of your heart with trust and go without any money. So he was another guru. Vinoba was my second guru. And you can't have dilettante relationship with your guru. As I said, you have to listen to his advice. And so we said, all right, Vinoba, if you say so, we trust you. And we decided to go without any money in our pockets. And we started from the grave of Mahatma Gandhi, and every day we walked 8 miles, 10 miles, 15 miles, even sometimes 20, 25 miles a day. And we walked to Moscow, we walked to Paris, we took a little boat from Calais to Dover. But we walked, and we walked to London, and we met Bertrand Russell. And Bertrand Russell was very pleased. He said, I'm delighted that my 1 week in prison inspired you. It's a wonderful welcome to England. I'm delighted. But then he said, I'm surprised to hear that you have walked without any money in your pockets. And you want to go to Washington. How are you going to go? Because you can't walk to Washington. So can I give you some money? And I said, Lord Russell, for 2 years, we have not touched money. So we cannot take any money. But if you are kind enough and generous enough to help us, we would like 2 tickets. And so he said to his secretary, they're all right. Please arrange 2 tickets for these two young pacifist Indians. And so he arranged 2 tickets in Queen Mary, the big boat. And so it was such a big boat that we sailed from Southampton to New York and we were walking in the boat, because you can walk in the boat. So we were pretending to be walking on water. And we arrived in New York and we arrived and walked to Washington, D.C. and we ended our journey at the grave of John F. Kennedy. So from the grave of Mahatma Gandhi to the grave of John F. Kennedy for 2.5 years. And then we wrote to Martin Luther King and we said, you had made this great speech of I have a dream. I have a small dream. You have a great dream. I have a small dream. And my dream is to meet you. And so Martin Luther King wrote to us back and said, oh, you come from India, the land of Mahatma Gandhi, who was my great inspiration. Come and see us. So we went to see Martin Luther King. And that was one of the highlights of our whole 2.5 years of journey. He was a real embodiment of peace. He said, nonviolence is not only a weapon to protest against racial discrimination. Nonviolence is a way of life. We have to embody nonviolence in everyday life. And that was the music to my ears. That was a very Gandhian message that Martin Luther King gave us. So that was walking for 2.5 years. I have written a book about it, No Destination. You can get it.
So I've got some questions about your walk.
Yes.
How did people know that you needed hospitality? And did you ever want for anything?
No. People will know how we are hospitality in 2-3 ways. First of all, we had a flyer. And in different languages, we got it translated, got help from people. And so in those flyers, in Persian, Russian, German, French, different languages, and we explained why we are walking, where we are going, why we are carrying no money, and we look for hospitality, and we also look for opportunities and occasions to communicate with people. So any schools or churches or mosques or public meetings, anywhere, or media, we would like to communicate our message of nonviolence and peace in the world. And so that was one. People will read it and say, oh, wow, you have walked all the way from India. Can we offer you some shoes, or can we offer you some haircut, or can we offer you some bed for the night? So we were giving. Then we also got very good media coverage. Every big city, wherever there were newspapers, we will go to them, their office, and tell them our story. And then they will put photographs, and they will write stories, and then we'll carry those paper stories. And some people will recognize, say, oh, we saw you in the newspaper. And so we were on the radio in Moscow, in London, BBC radio, and in Washington, and American radio. So radios, newspapers, meetings, public meetings, our flyers, and then people were also word of mouth. They will say, oh, you are staying with us. Go and stay in my family, such and such next town. Or go and say, my friend, I have a friend in such and such village or town. Go and stay there. So they were telephoning in advance that these 2 Indian peace walkers are coming. Please welcome them. Lots of stories like that.
And did you get bored of walking and of your friend's company?
There were days when when I felt a bit despondent and I felt, are we achieving anything? Is this worth doing? Because sometimes you have to go through mountains and through deserts of Persia and through snow in Russia and cold weather and you get blisters and sometimes you don't get hospitality. Sometimes we had to fast and we have to say, this is our opportunity to fast. And sometimes we had to sleep out under the stars because there was no hospitality. And so we will say, oh, we are staying, sometimes difficult, but other times we will say, we are now going to sleep in a million-star hotel and not a 5-star hotel. So there were days when we were not bored, but a bit tired, or a bit despondent, or a bit doubtful. But then occasionally people will come. I tell you one story. How are we doing with time? Okay. I'll tell you one story. We were walking. I gave this leaflet in Russian to two young ladies who were standing in front of a tea factory at a lunchtime. It was a sun like this. And it was a month of February, sunny, near Black Sea. So when they read the flyer, they say, "Oh, have you come all the way from India? Tell us, how did you cross these countries like Afghanistan and Iran? And what did you do?" We started to talk. And after, when they read that we have no money, say, "You have no money, do you want some tea? Do you want to eat something? We have a canteen in our tea factory. We work in this tea factory." I said, "All right, anytime is tea time, especially when you have no money." So we went in. And these two ladies, very nice young ladies, they made tea, they brought some bread, they brought some cheese, they brought some jam. Nice. We sat down, started to eat. After about 10 minutes, one of the lady stood up, had a brainwave of some kind. She went out of the room and came back with 4 packets of tea and said, "These 4 packets of tea are not for you. For whom are they?" I asked. She said, "Be my messenger, my ambassador, and please deliver 1 packet of tea to our premier, our government in Moscow, in the Kremlin. 2nd packet of tea to the president of France in Palace Elysee. 3rd packet of tea in the 10 Downing Street. And 4th packet of tea to the White House in the United States. And please give them a message from me." I said, "What is your message?" I was intrigued because, what is this packets of tea? She said, "My message to them is that if you ever get a mad thought of pressing the nuclear button, please stop for a moment and have a fresh cup of tea." And that will give you a moment to reflect in silence, reflect that your bombs are not going to kill only your enemies. Your bombs will kill men, women, children, civilians, farmers, workers, forests, animals, birds, insects. Everything will be destroyed. So please don't press the button. Wow, when I got this message, I had a kind of goose pimple. I could not believe my ears. This ordinary looking, very simple two young women working in this tea factory by a kind of Sochi in kind of by the Black Sea have this brilliant idea. I said to my friend, "Now whatever happens, whatever the difficulties, whatever the problems, we have to deliver this packets of peace tea." And so we continued walking and we delivered the packet of peace tea in Moscow and in a bit of great difficulty in Paris. You have to read the story. And then in 10 Downing Street and then in the White House. We delivered the packets of peace tea in these 4 nuclear capitals. And so those stories were so inspiring that our despondency, our doubt, our not boredom but more fatigue melt away. And we were inspired by such people. And then sometimes people will join us for 2 days, 3 days, 5 days. They will walk with us. And so much response and so much kind of emotional, intellectual, spiritual support from people that we were getting. That was very inspiring. I think I have lived 80 years. This is my 80th birthday this month. I'm 80 years old. But my 80 years of life, those 2.5 years are the jewel. They are the most outstanding 2.5 years. Because when you are touching the earth, you are out in nature. We learned that you have to make peace with nature. This woman said that your nuclear weapons will destroy the insects, the trees, the forests. So war is not only bad for humans, it's also bad for nature. So making peace with nature, making peace with humans, making peace with your heart, in your heart, all those things I learned while walking. Walking is keeps you in touch with the real world. And your mind is refreshed, your body is refreshed. For 2.5 years, we never fell ill, even for 1 day. No illness, no kind. Because when you are walking, you are very healthy. You are tired, you sleep well. You are tired, you get hungry, you eat well, and you are exercising. So for me, walk, that decision was the best decision of my life, that we'll walk to Moscow, Paris, London, Washington.
And you know, the walking and the power of walking, do you think it can affect other decisions? Your daily life, do you walk a lot now?
I walk every day, at least 1 hour. And I'm very fortunate. My wife is also a great walker. She loves walking. And weekends, we go for 2 hours, 3 hours. And when we have a little holiday, I say we'll go to Dartmoor. And we'll walk for 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours. So we walk every day. And walking is the best way of meditating. You are meditating on nature. You are meditating on the universe. You are meditating on the stars, the sun, the moon, the planet Earth, divine. The divinity is here, present, in the moment. Divinity is not in the next life. Divinity you experience when you are walking. It's a kind of deep meditation. So you are really the earth, the air, the water, the space, the fire, all four elements, you are in touch. I feel that all our science and technology and computers and iPads and iPhones and all the kind of Apple and apps and all these are all fine. But there are science and technology are only icing on the cake. The real cake is nature itself, the soil, the water, the rivers. And if you are not in touch, you are always working in front of computer and you are in the office, behind your desk, and you are always sort of in your head, you are not in touch with the real world. So walking, literally, you are in touch with your earth. Your feet are there on the earth. And so I would say, if you want to be happy, if you want to find joy, happiness is not in money. Happiness is not in jobs. Happiness is not in your office. Happiness is in yourself. When you are in touch with the soil, with the earth, walking, smelling, looking at the trees. The joy of life when you walk in nature. The flowers. When I walk in Dartmoor or Exmoor, the bluebells, the primroses, the kind of rose bay willow herb, the kind of sweet meadow or meadow sweet meadow and meadow sweet. That is the kind of joy and happiness that you find in walking. You are walking on divine earth. It's a kind of very spiritual practice. So I would say that walking is the best for me.
I agree. Anyway. So we have about 20 minutes left.
Yes, yes.
At the moment, you're 27 and a half years old and you have arrived in Washington.
Yes.
We've got 20 minutes to do the rest. We might have to do part two. But anyway, we'll press on.
Okay.
So how did you get from Washington to London and taking the job that you then held for 43 years?
Okay. So from Washington...
No idea. Was that a question from the floor?
Was there something?
Oh, outside. I think it's a message not meant for us.
Okay. We were also invited to Japan. One of the Buddhist teachers there said, how can you complete your peace pilgrimage against nuclear weapons without making a pilgrimage to Hiroshima? And so we will arrange everything. Just come and we'll send our Buddhist monks with you and walk from Tokyo to Hiroshima. And that was a wonderful invitation. So we went and walked from Tokyo to Hiroshima, another 45 days. And then we took a boat to come back to Bombay. And then I was invited by Canon Collins. He was a canon of St. Paul's Cathedral. And he said in 1968, he said to me that at the moment, there's a tremendous amount of violence among the young people. You remember the 68? And so come and teach us nonviolence. So I came back to England and he arranged everything. And I started something called London School of Nonviolence in the crypt of St. Martin in the Fields in Trafalgar Square. And at that time, I met another great man in my life, and that's called E.F. Schumacher, the author of Small is Beautiful. And he was at that time editor of Resurgence magazine, one of the editors. And he said that we are looking for a full-time editor. And I'm very impressed with your non-violence and peace and Gandhian ideas. So why don't you become the editor? And I said, Mr. Schumacher, I'm here for a short time to teach and talk about non-violence, but I must go back to India. Why you must go back to India? I said, I want to work with the Gandhian movement. And E.F. Schumacher said, Satish, there are many Gandhians in India. We need one in England. So stay and become the editor. So he was very persuasive, and he was a wonderful man. And so I said, all right, Mr. Schumacher, if I become the editor, would you contribute an article in every issue of Resurgence? And he said, for a minute he thought, and then said, all right, that's the deal. If you become the editor, I will contribute an article in every issue. And so I became editor in 1973 in the end. And so for the last 43 years, I have been editing Resurgence magazine, which brings together the spirituality, the ecology, and a social justice. What I call soil, soul, society. Soil represents the natural world and our dependence on the soil. Without the soil, there is nothing, no life. And the soul, the spirituality. Without developing our soul qualities, care of the soul, and compassion, and kindness, and happiness, and well-being, we cannot be happy out in the world. And then society, bringing whole world, our diversity is fine. Being British or American or Russian or Chinese or Hindu or Muslim or Christian, that's all fine. But these are diversities, and we must not change and turn this diversity into divisions and create conflicts and wars and social injustice. So bringing humanity together, before we are Americans and Russians, before we are Hindus and Muslims and Christians, we are human beings. And this human society, unity of humanity, that's the third. So Resurgence magazine brings these three together. And so this is why has been my passion. So you can say the Jain principles, the Buddhist principles, the Christian principles, the Gandhian principles, the humanitarian principles, they all come together in Resurgence magazine. It has been my kind of great privilege and a pleasure and an honor to be in Britain. I have found so many wonderful friends in Britain, in England, in Britain, And it has been a tremendous pleasure for me to be in your country and edit the magazine and be in the service of this country. Thank you.
We need to congratulate you because you are the longest serving editor of any British publication at 43 years, which is quite an achievement. So standing down now after 43 years. Yeah, another round of applause, I think.
Thank you. Thank you.
So in those years, what's the one article or interview that you think, oh, we really nailed it there? That was a moment for me.
By me or by somebody else?
I will have one from you and one from somebody else.
Okay. One from somebody else, I would say, is by E.F. Schumacher himself. He wrote a very beautiful essay, which we published in Resurgence, called Buddhist Economics. And people asked him, what Buddhism has to do with economics, or what spirituality has to do with economics? And he used to say, the economics without spirituality is like flowers without fragrance. And so spirituality brings meaning to economy and ecology. So that was... If you have not come across Buddhist Economics, it's a wonderful essay, and it was a great honor and pleasure for me to publish that in Resurgence magazine. My own articles, I have written so many, but one article which suddenly comes to my mind is something called Radical Pluralism. Now, because I think we somehow get stuck in one dogma, or one truth, or one particular way of being. And we think, this is it. I've got the truth. Everybody must follow my truth. This is the only truth. I think we need to move away from this idea of one single truth. There may be one single truth, but it manifests in many, many different ways. So radical pluralism, where we embrace different way of living and celebrate our differences, celebrate our pluralism, celebrate our diversity, biodiversity, cultural diversity, religious diversity, linguistic diversity, national diversity, racial diversity, and truth diversity. So this idea of pluralism, a radical pluralism, well, you can follow your truth. You follow your way. You follow, if you are a Christian, follow Christianity. But don't think that this is the only way. Like Rowan Williams said, who is the Archbishop of Canterbury formerly, he said, there are many ways to Jesus Christ, as you know. So, and he's a good friend of mine. So we have to embrace this idea of plurality, where it's good that we have so many different languages, so many different religions, so many different cultures. It'd be boring if 7 billion people upon this earth spoke only one language, English. Wouldn't it be boring? Even though I love English, I speak in English, I read Shakespeare, I read all the great poets, but it's good to have French and German and Chinese and Japanese and other languages, and Welsh. In the same way, it will be boring if all 7 billion people were all Hindus or Muslims or Buddhists or Christians or whatever. It's good to have different religions, different languages, different nationalities. But those are diversities. They are not divisions. We need to celebrate diversity. And that's my essay called Radical Pluralism.
Thank you. I've got so many questions, I can't fit them all in. So diversity is a real challenge for British society. You can see that playing out, especially through the summer. Is there anything in particular that you would encourage, given all the time that you've spent with us, observations you have about British society, about how we could be better at being truly diverse?
Yes. I would like to see our attention at the moment is very materialistic. We think that whatever we can measure exists, and what we cannot measure does not exist. I think in Britain, because of that, we have become a kind of more a materialistic consumer society. I would like to bring in that place more a spiritual dimension. And that spiritual dimension, I call it elegant simplicity. Living a life which is light footprint upon the earth and have a simplicity, elegant simplicity, quality of life rather than quantities of possessions. So elegant simplicity for me is that quality where you, good quality of food, good quality of clothing, good quality of house, but minimal, not too much. Because if we all live the way we are living in a wasteful way, this is a kind of wasteful world. And if we waste so much and pollute so much, then 7 billion people, if they all live the way British live or Americans live, we will need 2 or 3 planets. We have got only one planet. And so for me, the message in one two words is elegant simplicity. We need to live simple life, more beautiful life, joyful life, quality of life, good food, good things, but not too many and not too much. So unclutter. If your house and attic is full of clutter, unclutter it. Give it to Oxfam or other charity shops. And have few things in your house, but have beautiful things. William Morris used to always say that do not have anything in your house which you don't consider to be useful and beautiful at the same time. So William Morris is my hero in this matter. So elegant simplicity is my message.
Thank you, Satish. Now, I think I should probably see if there's anybody out there who'd like to ask a question. And while you're thinking, I've got one last one from me. You've spoken about gurus in your life. Do you have gurus now or any that you would recommend to us here at Greenbelt?
Not really. Now, I don't have guru in that way, which I did have. My mother was the best guru. She was a great spiritual guide to me. And then my Tulsi, Jain guru, and then Vinoba guru. But now what you can say is like you have a candle, and in order to light the candle, you need a matches. So you have the matches, you light the candle. Once the matches has lit the candle, then you don't have to have matches. So the guru for me was that matches. That guru is my, sort of lit me, you can say. They ignited me. And now I have to some extent absorbed their teachings in my heart, digested them, and then what I speak, I don't copy my guru. I don't just say, follow my guru or something. I don't preach my guru, gurus. But I say that whatever I am now, I have learned from them, I've digested them, I made those teachings of my own. And now what is coming is from my own heart, from my own experience. And I would like you to know that the idea of guru is not just a followership, just to follow your guru. It's not that. Take that idea from the guru, but be ignited. And then light is inside you. Your inner guru is the real guru. It's a guru is inside you. Your light is inside you. It's not outside. It's not in the books, not in any other person. It's each and every person has that potential. And that potential is ignited by your teacher or spiritual guide. But in the end, your light has to be within you. So your inner guru, so I try to have my inner guru now.
Thank you. So are there any questions from the audience? There's a gentleman down here. Thank you. I'll take this behind you then, okay. Get in your way.
Okay.
Thank you for an inspiring talk. Thinking about modern Europe, do you think you'd be able to do your walk now with all the borders and frontiers that are so hard to cross?
It will be a bit difficult. Situations have changed. But you know where there is a human determination and a will, in spite of difficulties, in spite of problems, if you really wish to do it, your ingenuity, your creativity, your imagination comes to play and you can do it. So I would not say that now it's too difficult, don't do it. Do it. And difficulties, welcome. Don't be shy of difficulties. The difficulties, if everything is smooth and clean and clear and laid for you and you don't have any difficulty, then it will become boring. But if you have a difficulty but you have a good heart and you have commitment and your dedication and your ingenuity, you use your imagination and find a solution. So I would say yes, even now you can make a pilgrimage from London to Moscow if you want to.
Any other questions? Oh, there's a lady just there.
When you were talking about the problem that everything has to be measured and it is only valued if it can be measured, I thought about the state that our education system's in at the moment, and I wondered if you could change it, how would you change it?
Yes. I would say education should include head, heart, and hands. At the moment, our education is 3 R's, reading, writing, arithmetic. They're not even 3 R's. So I would like to replace those 3 R's with 3 H's, head, heart, and hands. And heart is where spirituality comes in. You cannot measure. I think in classrooms, every day, children should be introduced the ideas of compassion, of relationship, of reverence, or respect, of divinity. All these ideas must be not any particular religion, but generally speaking, spirituality, respect for each other, respect for nature, respect for teachers, respect for parents. That kind of spirituality is a heart matter. That should be part of education. And then hands. Our children and our students from the universities come out of universities. They can't grow food. Many of them even can't cook. They can't mend anything. They can't make clothes. They can't make shoes. They can't build a house. No skills. So our education should include handy skills where children are taught to garden. Every British school should have a garden. Every British school should have a kitchen where children feel community. They have a good food, cooked, fresh, nice food by themselves and with the teachers together. Why not make a school with a kitchen and a cooking as a real lesson. So head, heart, and hands. If you can bring these three H's together, then reading, writing, arithmetic is all fine. We need it. It's good that we have reading, writing, arithmetic. But that's not enough in our education. It's too much measuring, too much exam-oriented. I think examination is only a minor part of education. The real education is to bring out what is inside you. Educare is to bring out what is inside. Like a seed, you cannot put a tree in the seed. The tree is in the seed. The gardener, the farmer, the orchard keeper only helps the seed to become a tree. So teacher's job is to help the child to become what the child is, she or he. What is their potential? Bring that out. That should be the purpose of education, not this measuring and exam. That's only a kind of small thing. We have made this be all and end all. Exam results become kind of dominant, and that's not right for education.
We have one last question from the lady over there.
I'd really like to know what happened to your friend who you did the walk with, and also, you know, did their lives take a similar path to yours?
Yes. My friend is still my good friend, but he is in India and I'm here, so we don't see each other so often. But when I go to India, I see him. I was in India this year, last April, and we had good meeting and good discussion and good eating together and walking together. So we see each other. We are still in touch. And for 2.5 years, when we were together, although occasionally we had argument, I must admit, but we never fell out. We remained friends, and we are still good friends.
Satish, I want to thank you so very much for the last hour or so. It's got my green belt, our green belt, off to a great sight, a start, great sight, Freudian slip. And just, I know that when I walk around sight now, I'll be thinking about my feet making contact with the ground. So yes. It's been a great way to start. I know it's your first time to green belt. I hope you have a lovely weekend.
Thank you.
Let's join and thank Satish for a great
thank
hour.
You. Thank 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 you.